Mr. Fine, Real 10. We're talking about your black market activities in Naples. Now, did you do this again? And if not, why not? Because it seems to have been fantastically profitable.
I can't remember. I know we didn't do it again. If it was the reason that I thought, don't be stupid a second time, I can't tell you. It may just have been the opportunity, wasn't it? I cannot honestly remember. All I can say, that was the one and all big operation.
Now, what was life like during your couple of days ashore? Well, a couple of days in harbour at Naples. You may not have got ashore.
You had one day ashore, well, one. You usually got one day ashore and one day duty watch on board.
Now, what was shore leave like in Naples? What would you do?
Well, I remember very clearly getting the opportunity to go to the palace, which is where Nelson lived when he was there. I think it was a canteen. I think it had been turned over as a canteen for port servicemen. I remember going up a very vast staircase where there was a plaque up there. We heard that this is where Nelson lived when he was in the Mediterranean. I don't know, but I know it was where he lived. The other thing of note, I'd always been interested in history. And we were given the option, or the offer, I should say, I think it was the army that organized it, to go and see Vesuvius and the ruins of Pompeii. We went in 30 hundredweight trucks, I can remember. It was a very, very bumpy ride because the little culverts and little bridges had been blown by the advancing troops coming up to Naples, and they'd just been filled in with rubbish and rubble. I can remember the journey being a very, very bumpy ride, but it was very interesting. I had subsequently been back to Pompeii since the war, after the war, but I remember being very interested, and I think it was, well, I don't think, I know it was time very well spent as opposed to thinking.
What was your normal, I mean, that's sort of touristy things, but what about normal night ashore in Naples? Well, what was that like?
There was one instance where it was in the very early days. I think it was the very first time we went ashore and the Germans were still in the outskirts. And we were only given shore leave on the understanding that we were armed with Lancasters, which is a naval form of Sten gun, and with 60 rounds of ammunition, the magazine was 30 rounds because it clipped in the side of these guns. We had a little bit of practice with them, not very much. And it required we were to put ourselves and the military rule if they wanted us. Naples was in a terrible state.
In what way? How badly done?
Ricks all over the harbour, heaps of rubble everywhere. But, as usual, the Church Army women were to the forefront and they'd open canteens for us. And as soon as we found one, we went in, threw our Lancasters in the corner, didn't want to go, and were drinking rough, new white wine. I think it would be better to call it white acid than white wine. And we had stomachs made of metal, I think, so what we must have absorbed. I don't remember being ill from it.
And what were the canteens like? What did they offer other than this?
Very little. Just drinking. They may have been tea. I don't think we were interested in tea or coffee.
What about bars? Italian bars. Were any open?
I don't remember going to them. It was just the canteens we went to. We might have been too scared. I don't remember. We all went as a herd into the canteens.
What about later on, when sort of... When
Well,
Naples was firmly under control. What would you do on a night then?
I don't think we were allowed ashore at night. I don't seem ever to remember nightly, but I could be wrong. I don't remember the team, but I will tell you this, that we came back on board when we took our Lanchesters with us, and if my memory is that somebody forgot their gun, I don't remember who it was, but I think he got into a very serious trouble. But I can remember no more details than just the outline of a problem. I'm almost certain we didn't have night leave.
How did you get on with the Italians?
I think we hardly had any contact with them. I don't seem to remember having any contact. If we did, it was part... None. First of all, we couldn't speak Italian, they couldn't speak English. And as far as we're concerned, they were of no consequence, I suppose. I don't honestly remember. We had no direct or long-standing contact with them.
And on the journey back, I mean, sometimes later on, it's from originally the troops were going to Italy, then the troops were going back for D-Day. Yeah. Anything you recall from the trips back, or were they better or worse, or any different? Because they also took 7 days.
Yeah, I don't think they were going out until...
So, not much... I mean, this seems to have been a fairly boring period.
Well, you were keyed up, but boring. You know, were very much on watch. To make sure nothing got through the screen. But, boring.
And this nickname of Millionaire's Run, yeah. How did you feel about that?
I think I only remember hearing it after the war.
Did you mind the fact you were on this, or would you rather have been on something more exciting?
It was a quiet number. Nobody goes to keep the trouble with that. We were rather pleased. We had quite a bit of a rough ride in the early part, or prior to that. So it was quite nice to have a quiet job.
Now, the next thing then is in November 1944, they took you off that and put you onto a sort of hunter-killer group.
Yes,
the whole of the 4th Escort Group, which has been on, was put onto this around about Ireland and, you know, Scotland, generally around the UK. Now, what do you remember of that?
Well, first of all, the weather was awful. I can remember that, by and large. Obviously, had good days. I can remember getting the signal, hearing the signal coming, that the Manners had been torpedoed in the Irish Sea, and we proceeded at a great rate of knots to go to her rescue, and we made contact with this U-boat underneath.
Yeah. So this is when you actually sank a U-boat, or...?
Yes, I'm just going to... And we searched for quite a while. She was laying there with Dongo. And I can't remember how or why, but our skipper decided to creep slowly over the spot using the echo sounder, which is a depth gauge. It sends pulses to the bottom to get depth. And you get a trace on iodized paper. And he ran the ship so carefully over the spot. You have to be admired of his ability to know what to do. But you've got the whole outline of the U-boat on the bottom traced out on the trace. And Mr. Easton and myself were watching this because it was in the charter. And I think our words were, "There's the bastard!" And I believe Commander Plain politely told us to moderate our language or something to that effect. We were reproved slightly, but not too harshly. We then went in and attacked with Hedgehog, hit the U-boat, and she came to the surface at great speed. We opened fire, aiming for the conning tower, and I can quite clearly remember seeing the conning tower facing towards us with a crest on the conning tower. And the Alma, which was another one of our sister ships, but the captain of the Alma was senior to our captain, decided to, and I'll quote, put this word, interfering. And we were told to stop firing because we had hit the Alma, because he went in and rammed the U-boat. Obviously there were no survivors and the U-boat went down like a broken cigar. But if my memory serves me correctly, our skipper was across the sail at least. And he signalled to the captain of the Alma, although he was considered senior, something like, "Our bird, your refit," I believe. We never heard more about that.
What did you think of what was it necessary, in your view, from your perspective on the bridge, for this ramming to occur, or was the submarine finished anyway?
I don't know. I think safety's better. Better get rid of it. I know a lot of people would say we should have saved life. Should they've done it to us? I don't think so.
But could they not have sunk it with the guns rather than the ramming? Because ramming's quite dangerous in a destroyer.
Well, not all the thick bows we had. We had special reinforced bows. Oh, yeah.
So it was all right.
Well, obviously there was some damage. But don't forget, you said gunfire. If we'd have let them come out and operate, I think they had 4.5s or 5-inch. They had quite much heavier guns. And if they'd have been able to fire their gun at us, they'd have made a hit us, we'd have suffered a lot of casualties and damage. I think it was the best thing to do, get rid of it. I mean, they wouldn't have looked kindly on us if they'd have had the opportunity. But our bows, all these bows were reinforced. Although the Almas was reinforced, she did damage herself, but not as badly as she would if she hadn't had reinforced bows. I think these bows were reinforced when all the ships came back to Belfast. They weren't, I don't think they were reinforced when they were first built. I think there's additional, I think so. I'm only going from memory, not hard fact.
So that was the great success. You don't. I think they know the U-boat it was, but I don't know whether you know the number.
I can look it up.
But we can. They can look it up.
Yeah, I can. I've got an idea, but 1051, something like that.
And this was on the 26th of January, 1945. Yeah. So that was quite early after you took over this. Took over.
Yes,
sort of went on to this
we
period.
We were one of the first to get a U-boat in this coastal water operation.
Now, what were the coastal water operations like generally?
Well, they were all over the place, up around the north of Scotland, around the coast of Ireland, across the channel approaches. You know, they were all areas where they felt U-boats might approach and come in. Our second U-boat was off the west coast of Ireland.
Well, do you want to tell that story then?
Yes, the U-boat was spotted by a fellow called Ken Risley, who was in the crow's nest. This is the guy I told you the story about earlier on in this discussion, where he evacuated his bows all over the mess deck after he got his award. But this is when he actually won his award. He spotted the periscope, and almost at the same time the Asdic picked it up, we went in and we sunk this U-boat as well.
Do you remember how it was done?
I think it was done with Hedgehog, but I won't be possible. In fact, I'm almost certain it was done with Hedgehog.
Had your radar picked up the periscope, or is that not possible?
No. If it was possible, we didn't pick it up. and I don't remember what happened. I would have been closed up for action stations, but I might have been on the plot. I can't tell you.
Now, what about the weather? You were talking about it earlier. What was the weather like in this period?
Pretty awful.
What was it like in bad weather? I mean, you've described it a bit, but I mean, now you had got used to it. How was it?
Fortunately, as I said before, you didn't get water down below. But the motion was violent, to say the least. Don't forget, we were 3 or 6 feet long, only 35 foot beam, and we only, the maximum, were about 9.5 to 10 feet below the water. And I don't forget, you had superstructure, you had masts, you had guns, you had all sorts of armour, you had deck, all on the deck. That in itself, when she started to roll, rolled with you. As I said, the famous saying was, these things would roll on a wet teacup.
And did you get used to it, or did you just...
Yes, you got used to it. From the point of view of being CC, I was quite used to it, more or less. Although, physically, you were thrown about to a great degree. I mean, you were thrown from side to side, and sometimes you were right up against the bulkhead. The force of gravity was a job to fight.
Were there minor injuries caused by it?
Well, I personally did, I realised, many years later, did suffer an injury. I can't tell you the actual time it happened, but I must have been thrown very violently against a bulkhead. And the first part of my body that made contact with the bulkhead was my left elbow. Now, I can't remember suffering a very deal of pain. You don't remember that. Obviously, I must have rubbed it and forgot about it. Many years later, which is now only about 3 years ago, which would be about 1997, I started getting an enormous amount of pain in that left elbow. I was sent by my doctor to see a specialist who x-rayed, and he decided to operate. And I have the pieces upstairs and a little while. I have 8 lumps of bone that were chipped off and become very, very uncomfortable and a very great deal of pain.
And that was caused in the war.
They reckon. I asked the specialist if I could claim for compensation or a pension, but he laughed at me and said it's too long ago. We couldn't prove that that was the damage. But it was reasonably certain that that was caused.
Now, what was the routine on these hunter killer?
Just the same.
But I mean, how many days would you go out for?
I don't remember. Varying times. Sometimes it was weeks or two, some of the days it was...
And how did you sail? I mean, did you all go off as a group? Or?
Yeah, the 4th Escort Group more or less stayed together the whole time.
So you
operate as a team.
But would you be in a line, or how would you be set about at sea?
Usually, if you were sweeping, it was like a crescent sea, with approximately 2,000 yards or so between each ship from the centre to the starboard or centre to port. You cover quite a wide area, probably 12,000 yards that way. But it did vary. It just depended on the set of circumstances. You see, what we didn't realise then, but it subsequently come to light, the senior officer was getting signals, radio signals. Obviously they were coded. They were codeless, deciphered. We were sent to areas to look for U-boats, which obviously we now realise was information they had picked up from Enigma. We didn't realise it. Nobody realised it, except the very few people who were operating it. But when you look back, you realise this was how we were sent to point A at a certain time and date. It didn't work perfectly, but obviously there were times when we made contact and times we didn't. But I realised that this must have been why we operated in a certain area at a certain time. makes sense, doesn't it?
Now, one thing, just a couple of questions. You had a new skipper. What had happened to the old skipper?
The old skipper was quite way back.
He packed up in May,
44. He was RNR, Lieutenant Commander. He'd been captain of a Castle Line liner before the war. And he developed an appendicitis and was put ashore. We never saw him again. For one trip, and this was out to the Mediterranean, our first lieutenant, it was Lieutenant Davidson, James Davidson, took over as skipper. And when we came back, a new skipper came aboard.
Now, what was Davidson like as skipper?
He was a regular. He was a great disciplinarian as a first lieutenant. But we had respect for him because he was very fair. I think I mentioned this before. I can remember him spending a long time on the bridge when he was skipper. He was constantly to be seen in the skipper's chair, day after day after day. How much sleep he got, I don't know, but I don't need him to get my sleep. Our new skipper is a Lieutenant Commander, Edward Plain, P-L-A-Y-N-E, who's been an amateur well-known yachtsman before the war, so he was obviously familiar with the sea. He was an enormously tall man. He was the second tallest man in the Navy. He very quiet, hardly said a word to a soul. I don't suppose, in the course of knowing him, I exchanged 50 words with him.
Was he popular? I mean, because although he may not have had, was he regarded as a good skipper?
Yes. I would think by and large people had respect for him. Yes. A good skipper usually got respect. The times I did come in contact with him, because going ashore as postman and navigating German, I used to pick up signals.
Now, tell me, because that's one thing we've missed out. Could you tell me what your job was as ship's postman now?
Well, you'd go to the mail office and you'd pick up, they knew you were from the caller. I don't think I had any form of identification, I can't remember.
So you'd take, when you got into a harbour, that's what you'd go ashore?
You'd take the mail ashore.
Who would collect the mail up on board ship?
It was posted into boxes, and the warden used to take it and send it. And it was put into sacks, if I remember rightly. I used to take the short dump it at the mail office and pick up our mail, the bags and the calls of them. If I was in town to do anything for that, I'd do shopping for the chaps. It's very advantageous because he'd come back about lunchtime, people would show their gratitude by offering you some of their top. And obviously picking up signals, some of those signals were addressed kept for the skipper, and I used to go in and give them to him, used to sign for them, and the exchange of words were very brief.
Now, that's one of your jobs. Now, as navigator's yeoman, we haven't discussed that as well. How much of a job was that, would you say?
First of all, we got threepence a day extra. Old money. My main job as regards navigator's yeoman was, each day when it was available to see the sun, the sextant came out, was brought out by the navigator, and he'd watch the sun, watch the taking, viewing, and his words to me would be stop. I then have to recall from a very special deck watch on a chart, on a graph, you know, on a paper, the exact time he said stop. Then he could work out from his tables the angles of the times. I don't understand that. That was navigational theory. The other thing I had to do was, one of the things when I used to go to the ashore as navigator, I had to go to the chart office. And there they would give you chart alterations. Some of them were marked top secret, and I was not allowed to touch those. I had to pass them straight over to the navigator. They obviously turned out, which I subsequently found out, to be alterations to minefields. All the rest was normal stuff, buoys, lights, changing wrecks, and I had to plot these on the charts. We used black Indian ink.
You mentioned that, yeah. Yeah. So was there anything else you had to do? So it was quite a not a big amount of your time spent doing this, from the sound of it, except going ashore.
It was, yeah. It took a long time to collect charts. It was fascinating. It was better than doing study decks and painting ship sides and things like that. You were absolved of all those responsibility duties. You were, it was a nice quiet job and I enjoyed it.
Now, anything else about the anti-submarine, the hunter-killer period?
It was just rushing about hither and thither, as I say, bad weather, and we were in Belfast, in Pollard Dock, on the morning of D-Day. I remember...
D-Day or VE-Day?
D-Day.
Because that's way before. Right, okay, so tell me about that, the news of D-Day.
I remember the radio, we used to have the radio playing, and the news coming in from every mess they had a round speaker, and was tuned into the radio office. And I remember hearing, paratroops are landing in France. The words that they said, November, for start. And of course, it was very exciting, because we realised this was. By, I happen to remember it. I can see the loudspeaker in the square box, and I remember sitting there, and we were all listening, and we started talking away. This must be the invasion.
Now, what about VE Day celebrations? That was May the 8th, and you were in Belfast then as well. Do you remember any particular celebrations or how you responded to the end of the war in Europe?
Day. Obviously, as you can imagine, we were highly delighted we survived. Whether it was VE Day itself, I think it was. I'd gone ashore with several of my friends. We consumed vast quantities and we were tired. We came back on board early hours, midnight, I don't remember. And the intentions of turning in. And somebody said, why waste the night? Or worse than anything. And about six of us decided to go ashore again. There was virtually no restriction. I don't think there was a jetty sentry, gangway, anybody about. Things were very relaxed, to say the least. And we were walking up York Road, to the centre of Belfast. And we saw some fellows fiddling, sailors fiddling with a car. But obviously, no music. We asked them what they were doing, and they said, let's so-and-so pub open up these doors to us. We can open these doors. And they took a wheel off. And I don't know if you ever seen the damage a wheel can do when it's bounced on a blown-up tyre. But it bounced and went straight through these double doors, and they just shattered. They were hanging on their hinges. In we went. Landlord came down the window, so he had to open the doors. I don't think all the bottles we got hold of were paid for. I can't remember, and I won't commit myself too much on that. But I know I finished up with a bottle in my hand and two bottles either side of my blouse. And we went up to town, and somebody dared us to climb up to Queen Victoria statue outside, sitting on the Belfast. And the dare in those days in the state we were in was no red rag to put up. We went, two other fellows and myself. And of course, we were knocking the heads off these bottles and drinking. And somebody said, what are you doing in the bottles? And it was decided, very stupidly, to try and hit the heads of the crowd gathered underneath when we were dropping. Fortunately, I'm glad to say, I don't think we hit him. But it didn't take very long before two RUC men clambered up behind us can just put the air because they come on jet. You're caught in trouble, you better come down. We went down very quietly and peacefully. Literally, as our feet hit the deck, we were physically thrown into the back of a Black Mariah and ripped off the Crumlin Road jail and subsequently found out. I can't remember being put in a cell, but I did wake up in a cell in the morning, being woken up by quite a pleasant sound and a cup of tea, to the effect that Colonel Jack was a cup of tea, and he told me to travel in a very forceful language back to the ship before I was had up for